The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
So welcome everybody. Thanks for the short interlude. I'm really happy to welcome you, but also to welcome our guest speaker tonight, Scotty Hall. Scotty has an important voice to share, and we're really lucky that they're willing to talk tonight and share all of their wisdom and beautiful heart with us. So a few things to mention. Scotty has been really involved with organizing the May Day festivities for some time and works at Barebones Puppet Theater. Began their meditation career in California, where they grew up, and then practiced with Noah Levine at Against the Stream before coming to Minneapolis. And Scotty is also the founder of Dharma Corps, which is a queer sangha and for queer folk and allies. And Scotty has been really a big part of all of the inclusivity efforts happening at Common Ground. And probably the thing that I appreciate most about Scotty is that he's really a person who works on living their values in everyday life.
Our commitment to the planet as Buddhist practitioners, and the subject of wise conduct, or sila. In this case, nurturing and honing a wisdom of restraint in our daily lives. And I started to really dig into why so often it's so easy to miss opportunities or skillful choices, to put things off, to make unskillful decisions, even when they might directly conflict with the truth we know in our hearts and minds. For example, the truth that climate change really exists and that many of the choices we make daily have a direct effect on it. I realized that my procrastination on working on this talk was this textbook example of how easily we can fall into a series of tiny, unskillful choices by not being mindful, by letting life live us instead of mindfully living life. Let's face it, the busy nature of our lives does not lend itself well to balance, and being out of balance does not support us in making skillful choices. Does this sound familiar to anyone? Yeah? Couple fingers? Alright. So, we're constantly juggling so many things to keep our jobs, to keep our families and friends happy, to keep a roof over our head. And then there's FOMO. People know what FOMO is? F-O-M-O? It's the fear of missing out. So FOMO causes us to say yes to too many things, to overcommit, or as my mom puts it, to burn the candle at both ends. And before we know it, we've lost our balance in our daily life. So how do we work on this? How do we regain our balance and proceed with our day-to-day lives without getting off-center or being sucked out of whack? Greta, I wish she's not here, she's a member of the Garden Forum group that I help lead, brought in the following Picasso quote the other day. Picasso said, "You must always work not just within, but below your needs. If you can handle three elements, handle only two. If you can handle 10, then handle only 5. In that way, the ones that you do handle, you handle with more ease, more mastery, and create a feeling of strength and reserve." So I love that last part, strength and reserve. It almost sounds like an oxymoron in relationship to American society. Strength suggests flexing dominance and muscle, while reserve implies the act of politely refraining. What we don't realize is that reserve often requires strength. They're not incompatible. This is what I mean by the wisdom of restraint. But the strength for this restraint is often hard to find, let alone uphold in a busy life. Buddhism teaches us that we have strategies to build skillfulness into our lives. We have learned to use meditation to awaken to mindfulness. So what is mindfulness? My teacher Noah Levine describes it as non-judgmental, investigative, kind, and responsive awareness. I'm going to read that again because it's kind of perfect. Non-judgmental, investigative, kind, and responsive awareness. The Common Ground website states that mindfulness meditation is the practice of waking up to the present moment and learning to be open and at ease with the unfolding conditions of life. With practice, mindfulness reveals deep wisdom, compassion, and intimacy with all things. I don't know if anyone else has had this experience, but I noticed this tendency in myself to attach to this idea that my practice is just times when I'm meditating. When I'm intentionally paying attention. I compartmentalize my time into now I'm sitting down to practice, and now I'm not. When I catch myself thinking this way, I often turn to the phrase, how we do anything is how we do everything. We're not a part of anything. So are we practicing only when we are on the cushion? We often fool ourselves into thinking this, that practice is only when we intentionally sit or put effort into awareness. But perhaps we need to step back and expand our view. The reality is, we are always in practice. Whatever we are doing is our practice. We are in practice every moment of the day. The real question, perhaps, is what are we really practicing? Are we practicing wise speech, or are we idly chattering about someone to a friend or coworker? Are we practicing present moment awareness, or are we practicing harboring a pissed off attitude at that cart in front of us that just carelessly swerved into the bike lane? Are we practicing radical forgiveness of ourselves after a night of staying out too late with friends and maybe working on a Dharma talk? Or are we practicing shame, guilt, and beating ourselves up over it? Are we practicing seeing things the way they really are by acknowledging the unseen consequences of simple everyday actions? Or are we continuing to ignore the reality that everything we do is practice? That everything we do leads us too little way from mindfulness. Not only do we juggle full schedules in our personal and professional lives, but we also experience sensory overload with advertising and commercialism. Daily, we negotiate the juxtaposition of what media and societal norms tell us. That consumerism is happiness, that growth equals success, and that natural resources are a thing that can be bought, owned, and traded. So, if we meditate for 30 to 45 minutes a day, every day, but spend 4 hours watching TV, another couple hours surfing the internet, and another 8 devoted to a job that perhaps reinforces a philosophy of consumerism, or exploits humans or nature for profits, what are we really spending most of our time practicing? I want to reinforce this again because it's so easy to forget. We are always in practice. Whatever we are doing is our practice. We are in practice every moment of the day. When we practice being present with this truth, when we are successful in holding that thought in our mind, it becomes easier for all the other pieces to fall into place, and the wisdom of restraint becomes something we organically are moved to do. In the same way that we pay attention to breath as we sit in this hall for meditation, we must pay attention to our actions outside of the center. For every choice that arises at each moment, we have the option to investigate results and to act skillfully or unskillfully. So let's talk a little more about sila and how we can apply it to climate change. Sila, which in Sanskrit means discipline, is an invitation to exercise discernment. It also sometimes is referred to as virtuous conduct. Sila is the part of the Eightfold Path that includes wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. So, for those of you that might not know a whole lot about Buddhism, give you it in a nutshell. So, the Eightfold Path is the fourth of the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are that there is suffering in life, and that some of the suffering is beyond our control, and some of it, possibly a little more than the stuff that's beyond our control, we inevitably bring on ourselves through craving, aversion, and delusion. But never fear, because luckily, one of the main principles of the Buddha's teaching is that there is a way out of suffering. And this way is the Eightfold Path. So my teacher Noah describes the Eightfold Path as gifting us not freedom from pain, but freedom from suffering from it. The Eightfold Path is divided into three parts: wisdom, practice, and ethics. And I should point out that it's not usually talked about in the order that I'm going to go through it today. So there's these three parts, wisdom, practice, and they're sometimes likened to a three-legged stool. They work together to balance the seat of the stool, but if you eliminate one of the legs, you can easily end up on your ass on the ground. Another way to look at the Eightfold Path is in the way that it's often depicted, which is spokes on a wheel. So they're all leading to the same center, which essentially is freedom from suffering or enlightenment. You really want to go for the big one. All right, so the Eightfold Path breaks down into three parts: wisdom, practice, ethics. In the wisdom realm, we have wise understanding or view and skillful intentions. Wise understanding is basically that you get the concept of the Four Noble Truths. So you understand that our reality is that suffering exists and that it is a part of. Skillful intention can be looked at as cultivating wisdom to let go of our bad habits, such as clinging to ideals, clinging to our ego, clinging to our opinions and beliefs, abandoning, grasping, and letting go of hatred. I rock this hoodie, I'm not wearing it today, but that's from the Sangha in California that I used to practice at, and on the back it says the words, meditate and destroy. When people ask me what it is I want to destroy, I often reply, my ego. Although it might not be the way any of you choose to phrase, choose to phrase it, the adage reflects my deep commitment to cultivating skillful intention and the wisdom to let go. I see the wisdom point part of the Eightfold Path is how we relate to practice, how we relate our practice to our thinking and understanding. So it's the work we do in our cerebral process. So we have wisdom, practice, ethics. Next we have practice, which includes skillful effort, mindfulness, and concentration. So the practice is about our commitment to the physical activity of meditation. So this is very important, right? This is one of the reasons that we all come to the center, so that we can sit, meditate together, and it's how we kind of investigate and hone our meditative mind. Then finally, we come to the ethics portion of the Eightfold Path. Ethics is about how we use our practice when we are off the cushion. It's about how we choose to act and interact physically in the world. I've heard it referred to as engaged Buddhism. But one of my favorite descriptions is what one of the teachers at Against the Stream uses, which is full contact dharma. Very visceral. You like that? So, ethics includes right speech, right livelihood, and right action. Right speech, or skillful communication, includes everything from lying, slander, gossip, to just checking yourself so you refrain from the urge to be a jerk to your sweetie when you've woken up on the wrong side of the bed. Right livelihood, or skillful service, looks at our choice of work and whether our work nurtures our spiritual growth and journey. It pushes us to find work or volunteer opportunities that serve others as well as ourselves. Right action is about acting. It's about not just doing whatever we want whenever we want to, but instead acting with intention. It is usually accompanied with the five precepts, which are essentially the big no-nos in Buddhism. So, no killing, no drugs, no stealing, no lie, no abuse sex. Sila invites us to take this even farther. It's not just about the big no-brainers of don't go murdering people, robbing banks, or selling children. It provides an opportunity to investigate our actions on a much more sophisticated level than that. When applied to simple everyday life choices, it can provide us with the ability to discern what effects our minor cravings have on the long-term bigger picture. When we're being mindful of it, sila can be an awesome tool which directs us to question what is harmful in our everyday actions. choice that we come to in each moment. We have the option to investigate possible results and act skillfully or unskillfully. The resulting answer often goes hand in hand with renunciation, which is an easy thing to have aversion to. It takes practice, but with integrity and intention, we can cultivate discipline and restraint in our everyday actions. When our lives are too busy and out of balance, however, autopilot becomes the natural state that kicks in, and we often end up making choices absentmindedly or out of habit. Sila helps us recognize that life is a series of choices. Some are big, like should I buy a house or should we have a baby, but most are small yet defining, and that they reveal our relationship to the planet and our care for the beings that live on Earth. I love to cook and share food with friends and family. And when I'm not being mindful in my planning, shopping, and cooking, I will buy and make unnecessarily large amounts of food. I get wrapped up in the action of dana, the practice of generosity, and how it feels for me to be providing an indulgent, delicious meal, and how much this shows that I love everyone. And inevitably, I end up past a tipping point, where I'm blinded by the warm fuzzies I get from giving, and I end up neglecting the reality that there is a finite amount of natural resources on the planet, and there are 20 million plus species that I need to share with them. Caring for my friends and family is an important, skillful action. But showing I care by restraining my use of resources is an act of virtue that includes all living beings. I could choose to look at it as something I have to give up, or I can see that it is an act of loving kindness on a much bigger scale. It is at these moments when wisdom is most challenging, yet also so needed. So how do we make these smaller choices, no-brainers like the big ones? The same way we learn to meditate, by slowing down and simplifying and going through our day-to-day actions while we are off the cushion with the same careful intention we strive for when off the cushion. It is as important to take time to reflect both before and after we act. So this is a really important point. The more time we have to reflect before acting and afterwards, the more we can witness and appreciate the rewards of wise conduct or sila. So Mark Nunberg is the guiding teacher here, and one of his regular sayings is get curious. And I feel like this is like the perfect fit for that saying here. This investigation can be painful and embarrassing, but if we meet it with radical acceptance and loving kindness, it can also be a humbling and powerful teacher. Against the Streams, Matthew Brensilver says, "The beauty of Buddhism is that we can be radically accountable for our behavior, but at the same time, we can see the innocence of the situation of our being. We can be radically accountable for our conduct and not have a trace of self-harshness or guilt." I love that. So good to be forgiving of ourselves. All right, so we must never forget to forgive ourselves for our imperfect beingness and for being a learner. I want to share this statement. So this came out of the Vipassana Meditation Teachers Annual Global Conference in 2013. And it was the first time that they had ever included a discussion on climate change as part of their agenda. And it is called The Earth is Witness, International Dharma Teacher's Statement on Climate Change. So in keeping with tonight's spirit of active listening, I have a single document which I'd like to pass around so we can hear and learn from many different voices that make up this little community we have in here. So don't feel obligated to read, but speak loudly so everyone can hear, and maybe just take a paragraph or something. Oh, you do.
Okay, let me see. Earth as witness. Today, humanity faces an unprecedented crisis of almost unimaginable magnitude. Escalating climate change is altering the global environment so drastically as to force the Earth into a new geological age. Unprecedented levels of suffering for all life on Earth, including human, will result. Significant reductions in greenhouse gases and other actions will be needed to reduce climate change to manageable levels. But more fundamental changes are also needed, and this is where we can draw guidance from the rich resources of the Buddhist teachings, the Dharma. This statement briefly describes core Buddhist insights into the root causes of the climate crisis and suggests ways to minimize its potentially tragic consequences.
As a starting point, the Dharma states that to formulate meaningful solutions to any problem, we must first acknowledge the truth of our suffering. As shocking and painful as it may be, we must recognize that without swift and dramatic reductions in fossil fuel use and major efforts to increase carbon sequestration, the global temperatures will rise close to or beyond 2 degrees Celsius. This increase will lead to injury and death for millions of people worldwide and to the extinction of many of the Earth's species. Millions more will experience severe trauma and stress that threaten their physical, emotional, and psychological well-being.
These stresses will, in turn, trigger social and political unrest and a great injustice. Low-income communities, poor nations, and people systematically subjected to oppression and discrimination who contributed little to climate change will initially be harmed the most. Even worse, as frightening as it is, if we fail to make fundamental changes in our energy, manufacturing, transportation, forestry, agricultural, and other systems, along with our consumption patterns, with utmost urgency, in mere decades, irreversible climate shifts will occur that undermine the very pillars of human civilization. Only by recognizing these truths can we adopt a meaningful path forward toward solutions. Teaches us the origin of our suffering. The majority of the world's climate scientists are unequivocal that on the external physical plane, climate change is caused by the historic and ongoing use of fossil fuels and the greenhouse gases they generate when burned. Destructive land management practices such as clearing forests also contribute by reducing nature's capacity to sequester carbon. The Dharma informs us, however, that craving, aversion, and delusion within the human mind are the root causes of vast human suffering. Just as these mental factors have throughout history led to the oppression, abuse, and exploitation of indigenous peoples and others outside the halls of wealth and power, craving, aversion, and delusion are also root causes of climate change.
The Dharma offers hope by teaching us that it is possible to overcome the detrimental forces of craving, aversion, and delusion. We can use the climate crisis as a catalyst to acknowledge the consequences of our craving for more and more material wealth and the pursuit of power, and realize we must change our assumptions, attitudes, and behaviors. We can use the climate crisis as a catalyst to educate ourselves about planetary processes so we understand that the Earth has ecological limits and thresholds that must not be crossed. By learning from our mistaken beliefs and activities, we can create more equitable, compassionate, and mindful societies that generate greater individual and collective well-being while reducing climate change to manageable levels.
Finally, the Dharma describes the pathway of principles and practices we can follow to minimize climate change and the suffering it causes. The first principle is wisdom. From this point forward in history, we must all acknowledge not only the external causes of climate change, but the internal mental drivers as well, and their horrific consequences. To be wise, we must also individually and as a society adopt the firm intention to do whatever is necessary, no matter what the cost, to reduce the climate crisis to manageable levels and over time re-stabilize our planet's climate.
The second Dharma principle is ethical conduct, which is rooted in a compassionate concern for all living beings in the vast web of life. We need to make a firm moral commitment to adopt ways of living that protect the climate and help restore the Earth's ecosystems and living organisms. In our personal lives, we should recognize the value of contentment and sufficiency and realize that after a certain modest level, additional consumption, material wealth, and power will not bring happiness.
To fulfill our wider moral responsibility, we must join with others, stand up to the vested interests that oppose change, and demand that our economic, social, and political institutions be fundamentally altered so they protect the climate and offer nurturance and support for all of humanity in a just and equitable manner. We must insist that governments and corporations contribute to a stable climate and a healthy environment for all people and cultures worldwide, now and in the future. We must further insist that specific scientifically credible global emission reduction targets be set and means adopted to effectively monitor and enforce them.
The third Dharma training, and the one that makes all of the others possible, is mindfulness. This offers a way to heighten our awareness of and then to regulate our desires and emotions, and the thoughts and behaviors they generate. By continually enhancing our awareness, we can increasingly notice when we are causing harm to others, the climate, ourselves, and strengthen our capacity to rapidly shift gears and think and act constructively. Mindfulness increases awareness of our inherent interdependency with other people and the natural environment, and of values that enhance human dignity rather than subordinate people, animals, and nature to the craving for more material wealth and power.
Mindfulness
As we each awaken to our responsibility to follow the path described in the Dharma to help us protect and restore the planet and its inhabitants, we may feel awed by the immensity of the challenge. We should take heart, however, in the power of collective action. Buddhists can join with others in their sanghas, and our sanghas can hold joint hands and hearts with other religious and spiritual traditions, as well as secular movements focused on social change.
In this way, we will support each other as we make the necessary shifts in perspectives, lifestyles, and economic and institutional systems required to reduce climate change to manageable levels. History shows that with concerted, unified, collective effort, changes that at one time seemed impossible have time and again come to pass.
When we come together to celebrate our love for the natural world and all of the beings that inhabit it, and when we take a stand to counter the forces of craving, aversion, and delusion, we reclaim our own inner stability and strength and live closer to the truth, closer to the Dharma. Together we can seek to ensure that our descendants and fellow species inherit a livable planet. Individually and collectively, we will be honoring the great legacy of the Dharma and fulfill our heart's deepest wish to serve and protect all life.
So there's copies of that outside. If anyone wants to grab one, or you can find it on the internet. Okay, no idea how long. Okay, we have 20 minutes to chat to the group.
I really appreciate I really appreciate that tying in the Dharma to my life, you know, to the world, because it's everything, you know, all together.
So I was talking with a Buddhist nun a few years back, and someone else in the group asked her about renunciation, something about renunciation, and her response was that renunciation is another word for bliss. And that's always stayed with me. And what I wanted to say is, I've been working with that a lot, you know, since then, and I just wanted people to know that this magic thing happens when you watch, you know, when you pay attention to yourself and to your thoughts and to your emotions, when you stop wanting that thing that you're clinging to, it brings so much joy. And I think, for instance, you know, money is something for me that I used to have a lot of stress around, and just watching it over the years and watching it and paying attention, and, you know, letting go to the point where, you know, I don't really want money anymore. And it's a really joyful thing. I mean, it's a thing that can bring great joy. And I, you know, there's a lot of, you know, we think of restraint as being difficult and as not getting what we really want, sort of. But there's a really, really positive side to it for our own inner happiness.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
I want to go on that because for the last, I'm a college student, so for the last semester I've been taking a class that has been kind of incorporating some of the Buddhist teachings, and I started to realize a few months in that I started to become less wanting things, and at one point I get stuff like gift cards and stuff, and I'm like, oh, I want to get something, but then when I try and get something or buy something, I realize like, I really don't want anything, and I find no use for it, and after a while, I start spending it on other people and not on myself, and I realize that it's kind of like, after a while, you realize you don't really need as much as you really desire.
It's easy, especially in America, I think, to buy into the big lie that, you know, being part of the 1% or being wealthy and having all these material things is going to bring you happiness. Ask anybody who has everything, they'll tell you that it's just more distractions and you're just trading one set of problems for others. And it's also, I think, it's easy to become cynical and to listen again to the big lie in the media and how, you know, you're supposed to strive for this car and that house and this vacation and, you know, all those things. And you become cynical about everything, and so you don't even try. You don't pick up the van, you don't try and get together with your friends and your community and try and make improvements. And it can be done. Feel so helpless a lot of times too, but there's strength in numbers. So I'm trying to add something.
So I was living in San Francisco, and I had this lovely BMW that someone had given me for free. It was super sporty, and I loved it. And but I also have been very always. I read the news and I keep up on current events, and it was just a little after Gulf War II started, and we were kind of doing really regular protests in San Francisco against the war, and every bit of news that I saw was connecting, like, you know, our obsession with oil to this war. And it got to the point where I literally sounds crazy. This is why I didn't want to talk about this, but I literally started imagining when I was putting gas in my car that it was essentially equivalent to holding a gun to someone's head. And I would just feel like I've never held a gun to someone's head yet. I'm like, there's some sort of disconnect, and I'm like happily putting gasoline in my fucking BMW, you know? Like, what the hell? And so eventually that just got to this point where I was like, want this anymore, you know, it just became too, like, visceral and gross, and I picked a date, and I went and I took it to a junkyard, and I just got rid of it, and I had this whole fantasy that I was going to buy a bicycle the same day, and then just go smoothly from having a car to a bike, and I wasn't able to buy a bike, and the next day, on my way to work, it started raining, and I was, like, standing at a bus stop in the rain, so upset, but it really did just happen kind of organically, because I didn't shut myself off to being aware of other things that are happening in the world. So I feel like that is definitely one way that you can do it, but some of it just takes kind of like doing the work. It's like just like dealing with those icky feelings or realizing, okay, when these icky feelings come up, why is it icky? And then investigating that even though you don't want to. And I think it's a lot easier to do that when I'm in therapy, you know, with my therapist, or I'm sitting in, you know, a Dharma hall on retreat listening to a teacher. And then when you're just kind of like out in the real world, getting ready for work or whatever. But, you know, you just have to. I mean, I guess you don't have to, but eventually, at least I've come to a point where you just have to. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you.
Does anyone else have examples of things in their life that have pushed them?
This is on a different kind of level, but a practice that I found really helpful is to kind of tune into the whole kind of movement of generations in the past and the generations in the future. And so I am now the generation that is embodied, but there are generations before me that are still embodied and are no longer, and then generations that will. So then when I make a choice to use fewer resources, I feel like I'm kind of winking at the future beings and saying, I'm in league with you. And that is just an incredibly beautiful, joyful feeling. And that helps me a lot of choices.
I think about this a lot in my house. You know, that's one day I just realized that I'm using a gallon and a half of water to get to the warm water in the bathroom. Do people worry about that? I did it for years, and then what the hell am I going to do? You know, how am I going to get? Why am I doing this in Europe? They have the heater right there in the bathroom. There are ways of doing it. I'm not a scientist or an engineer, but I hope those things are going to start coming. I decided to just buy a white bucket because my bathroom is white, and I put the bucket in the tub, and I save a gallon and a half of water by running it in the tub, and then I use it in the toilet. So, and I just use, one thing, or one bucket in the bathroom, but that's one little example, but it makes me feel so darn good. But then, I have people in the house with me that absolutely will not do that. So that creates a little bit of stress in my life. Like, I'm like, why am I paying to my energy? So I'm just trying to sort of settle in with some of this, too. And just keep doing it myself and try to gently talk to others about things like turning lights off and all of it. It's kind of a big part of my life, pulling this stuff back.
Jeffrey and Scotty, as long as I've known you, I just wanted to say that you've been an inspiration in this field for me. Just watching you, as Shelley said, live these values in your daily life, and knowing you as well as I do, just watching you, knowing the story about your car and giving that up, and your sensitivity to what it means, just paying attention to what our small actions throughout the day mean, knowing where you buy your clothes and paying attention to the labels and or lack of labels, where it's made, what kinds of materials it comes from, the food choices you make. In so many different ways, I just see you living the commitment to these values in your life. And it's been an inspiration to me to continue doing that in whatever ways I can in my life, and finding new ways to do that. And I just wonder, I guess there's something that runs through my mind, this gentleman here kind of touched on it, which is, I'm curious to hear how you think about, sometimes the person that I know in my life, like Tom just mentioned, that refuses to participate or just doesn't want to pay attention and doesn't care. And sometimes I feel like I look around the world and I live in a bit of an insular bubble where I don't live very far from work. I don't spend a lot of... I live a pretty frugal life. I compost. I do all of these things, but I look around. And sometimes I feel like I'm looking at a world that isn't paying attention to any of this. And most of the connections I have here at Common Ground are people that pay attention, but when I look around the world at large, I feel kind of a sense of defeat about it. And not only are some people just ignorant, and if they knew what their choices meant, they might make a change, but some people know and still choose to make bad choices. And I'm just wondering how you frame that and how you deal with the idea that, human nature inherently is... there's greed and anger and delusion, and sometimes it takes us collectively in a place maybe where individually we wouldn't want to go. And how do you reconcile that?
Well, that's a tough one. Can't really control other people. Practicing radical acceptance in terms of what other people are choosing to do, not always that successful in it. But I also, I try to bring things into all aspects of my life. So, for example, at my work last year, my boss left and I kind of moved into her position. And I work at a concert hall and we have concessions. And one of the first things I did was get rid of every plastic bottle that we sold. It was like, we're only going to have cans, or we're going to have things that come in glass. So, that was like this thing that I had control over, that I kind of made adjustments. And at the same time, when we have our staff meetings, and I say things like, we should become a green theater and make it so any client that comes in to use the concert hall can't bring bottled water. They all look at me like I'm crazy, but at least I said it, at least I got it out there. I think that we have to do the most we can do in our lives, and then we can't let ourselves feel too crazy about what other people are thinking, because that is just it. On the slope, you'll just be miserable. You can't. It's the grasping, essentially, for wanting somebody to change. But I do think that there's probably a lot of things in our daily lives that we haven't even realized that we could be making a change. So it's about taking the time to investigate that.
I think it's huge when people make changes in their lives. The example, just setting the example, I think it really affects people that don't yet do it, either because they're ignorant or just because they don't choose to. I think that's huge. And I also mentioned in your thought of your example of winking at future generations, winking at past also. You know, because such a different, I mean, we have such a different way of life that is ruining the world, you know, and, you know, so.
Thank you. So let's sit for like 30 seconds. Let it go.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.